Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this retreat, for the founding of Sanpani Ashram, and for being here at this last session of the retreat, which will begin with a satsang and then followed by meditation afterward. And we'll begin with the bhajan in just a moment. And the bhajan is on page 41.
Tapde hirde thare ake. After coming, he cooled the heated hearts by showering the rain of Naam. The true Sadguru has come to remove the pains of the suffering ones. The place where beloved Kripal resides is blooming. Time after time, he planted the plants of Naam and gave the water of Satsang. Hail, hail, beloved Kripal. He attached the dear ones to his feet, showing the path of five Shavas. He united them in him. Removing the differences of duality, he taught only one Shabda. Beloved Kripal is present everywhere, absorbed in the eyes. The beautiful one who is present in all is obtained by the rare ones. He taught one Shabad after making us forget all the knowledge of the world. Das Jayap makes this prayer. Listen, O beloved Kripal, we have fallen at your door. Save our honor, O giver, filling the Jholi of Naam. He taught to fill the Jholis of Naam. After coming, he cooled the heated hearts by showering the rain of Naam. The true Sadguru has come to remove the pains of the suffering ones.
Tap de hirde thare aake Naam dami varsa gaya दर्द निवारण दुखियां वाले सचा सतगुरु आ गया तप दे हृदय ठारे आके नाम दमी बरसा गया दर्द निवारण दुखियां वाले सच्चा सतगुरु आ गया जिस थां ते किरपाल प्यारा ओथे बाग बारा समय समय सिर लाए बूटे अज खेड़ियां गुलजारा जिस थां ते किरपाल प्यारा ओथे बाग बारा समय समय सिर लाए बूटे आज खिड़ियां गुलजारा नाम दे बूटे लाए उसने सतसंग पानी पा गया दर्द निवारण दुखियां वाले सच्चा सतगुरु आ गया तप दे हृदय ठारे आके नाम दमी वरसा गया दर्द निवारण दुखियां वाले सच्चा सतगुरु आ गया तन तन किरपाल प्यारा अपनी चरणी ला लिया पंच शब्द दारसता दस के अपने वेच मिला लिया। धन धन किरपाल प्यारा अपनी चरणी लालिया। पंच शब्द दा रसता दस के अपने वेच मिला लिया। दुई दो वैत दा भेद मिटा के इको शब्द सिखा गया। दर्द निवारण दुखिया वाले सच्चा सतगुरु आ गया। तप दे हिरदे ठारे आके नाम दामी वरसा गया। दर्द निवारण दुखिया वाले सच्चा सतगुरु आ गया। हर थां ते किरपाल प्यारा अखियां वेच समाया है। घट घट दे विच वसदा सोना विरले ने ही पाया है। हर थां ते किरपाल प्यारा अखियां वेच समाया है। घट घट दे विच वसदा सोना विरले ने ही पाया है। दुनिया दे सब इलम छुड़ा के इको शब्द सिखा गया। दर्द निवारण दुखिया वाले सच्चा सतगुरु आ गया। तप दे हिरदे ठारे आके नाम दमी वरसा गया। दर्द निवारण दुखिया वाले सच्चा सतगुरु आ गया। दास अजायब अरजा करदा सुन किरपाल प्यारिया। दर तेरे ते टटे आके रखी लाज दा तारिया। दास अजायब अरजा करदा सुन किरपाल प्यारिया। दर तेरे ते डटे आके रखी लाज दा तारिया। नाम दान दी झोली भर के झोली भरन सिखा गया। दर्द निवारण दुखिया वाले सच्चा सतगुरु आ गया। तप दे हिरदे ठारे आके नाम दमी वरसा गया। दर्द निवारण दुखिया वाले सच्चा सतगुरु आ गया।
Yeah, go ahead, Russell G, anytime you're ready.
Oh, hello, everybody. This is the Sant Bani Ashram. This is one of the most memorable days of my life. You could say that my life was totally different after October 11th, 1963, than it was before. It happened that day. It reverberated down the years with tremendous reverberation. Anyway, we're going to see a movie. This is the movie that was taken at the time. 8mm movie, kind of jerky, not really up to what we expect by today's standards. But still, it's a record of what happened. Movie was taken mostly by Kuku, that is the Princess Narendra, although she appears in one scene, so somebody took parts of it besides her. But I know that she took most of it. And it began, there's a sequence at the beginning that is not going to be there. That is, Miriam and I went to meet the master on Interstate 93, which at that time ended in Northfield at exit 19. And so we drove over to Franklin coming from the ashram, we drove over to Northfield and I drove up onto the highway and parked. And then Miriam and I stood outside the car waiting for the master to come. She was 3.5 years old and I held her in my arms most of the time. And as the caravan came up, Kuku took the picture of us standing there. And she loved that sequence, she told me. I borrowed that movie. She took it with her back to India. And when I was there in 1969, I asked her if I could borrow it, take it home, because we wanted to copy it. And she reluctantly agreed and begged me to be careful with it. And I brought it home, and it was a big, big thing, and we had a big satsang, and I started running the movie, and it got jammed up in the projector. This, of course, was long before video days. And I kept trying to fiddle with it, and Judith begged me to stop. She said, "You'll ruin the whole thing," and I darn near did. But I was too arrogant and convinced that I could fix it. And eventually I ended up ruining that whole scene of Miriam and I standing there waiting for the master to come. Which, when Kuku came to know about it, she was extremely unhappy. Anyway, you'll see the movie without that, and I will try to narrate it as we go along, because it does show most of the seminal events of that day. It was actually, of course, it was a 24-hour period, but the master came around noon on, don't start it yet, please. The master came around noon on, I think it was Friday, and stayed until around noon on Saturday. And he was there 24 hours, but part of it was on October 12th. Anyway, we drove, of course, I had to drive back from Northfield. I drove through Willow Hill on Franklin, took a side street up and joined onto 127, and then drove up from there. And this is Kuku is taking the pictures. They're following, I guess that's, I ought to be my car, because she was in the car with the master, who was directly behind me, but I don't know, it doesn't seem like it is. But anyway, a lot of stuff is vague in my memory now. But, all right, should start the movie, Robert. Yeah, and we'll see.
Okay.
It goes pretty fast, so if I don't, I may get behind on the narration, we'll see. Okay, we're moving along now. We're coming up Osgood Road this time. One of the people who was in the party had a ton of stuff in there. Going past there's Amy Sandville greeting the master. She got initiated a year later. Here we are at the big house. Judith is standing there with Eric in her arms. There's Judith with Eric. People are going, master is, I think, already gone in. Now, this is the famous satsang at the Rock. Master is there, And there's Miriam. And Doris Yokelson is patting her. And that was Mr. Connor visible. And Master, no, I was not at this satsang, which I'll explain later. I wished I had been, but I wasn't. Now Master's going to take picture of everybody else because they were all taking pictures of him. He's elaborately doing this. The picture was that he took was on the wall at San Fani in the big house for many years. It was totally, it was combined with several pictures. It was very interesting. As I used to say, this may be how he seemed to him. Is you know, one picture is superimposed upon another. Anyway, now he's putting people in meditation, sitting on the rock. Miriam's bucket, you'll notice that she played with, he never touched it. He left it right where it was. I should say it was very rare for Master to sit in meditation with disciples. His usual procedure was to put them in meditation and then leave. But this time he didn't do that. Now, this is the following morning, and we're getting ready. We're going up to Vermont to, there's Cuckoo. Is taking, not taking movies, but taking stills at this point. I believe that I am talking to the master there. Yeah, that's me picking up whatever it was that dropped. There's Cuckoo again. Lovely lady. There's Taiji. There's Ben Ringel talking with Master. He's the one who lost a muffler in his car when he hit the dirt road. I think that's Ben. It's hard to tell from behind, but it looks like him. They're all getting ready to go. There was a group picture taken at some point. I'm not sure if that's in the movie or not. Wava Sanderson and Seymour Sweatsoff, who were very influential with me and when I first started going to satsang in Boston or talking to the master. Wava was the group leader. Maud Freeman, who is Mr. Connor's secretary. Steve Douglas is carrying stuff. Yeah, there's the group photo. I knew it was there. And I don't know. That's Jim Forte over on the side. And I don't know what his problem was with his foot, but there it was, something. Yeah, I'm standing with Miriam in my arms behind Mr. Connor, looking at Master. Now we are leaving, I believe. Yep, there we go, down the road, on our way to Vermont. Yes. Yes, and that was the end of it. Well, I wanted to go over some of the things that led up to that particular day. And I, you know, the way in which the ashram came about was a long process over a couple of years actually. It involved, you know, a lot of personal stuff with Judith and me, as well as stuff connected with the buying of the ashram. And I, hard for me to just, you know, to differentiate the personal from the ashram itself. And that's understandable because for many years, my life and the ashram's life were totally intertwined. And I was totally identified with it. And so that it's very hard to separate the personal and the not so personal. Anyway, I'm going to read from my book, Stumbling Toward God. And I want to start with when Judith and I came back onto the path, as probably everyone knows, because I've said, talked about it often enough. We were off the path for a couple of years after we got married. The events surrounding our marriage, our elopement and so forth, made us think that the master wouldn't want us actually anymore. And we used that as an excuse, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, we didn't meditate for a couple of years and didn't connect with satsang, except Nina. We did keep in touch with Nina up in Vermont because, of course, that was a very deep connection going back to the purchasing of that property also. And in September 1961, just before Eric was born, actually, one afternoon, I was working at the Journal Transcript at the time, which was the newspaper in Franklin, the weekly newspaper, and it was also a print shop. That's where I learned the printer's trade, was at that Journal Transcript. Although I had gone, I had learned linotype at a school in New York. I was working on a paper cutter at the print shop when the thought came to me completely unexpectedly. Suppose I went back on the path, what would it be like? I began thinking as I worked of all the adjustments and accommodations I would need to make before such a thing could happen. At first, it seemed impossible, but by the end of the afternoon, I knew that it had already happened in spite of me. I was going back on the path. I went home and told Judith, and she was astounded. She did not share my feelings then, but she did a little later. The next morning, I got up early and sat for meditation, the first time in 2 years. I assumed that it would be as easy as it had been before I had stopped. I got a bitter lesson indeed, one of the bitterest I had ever gotten up to that time. I sat with my eyes closed and saw nothing whatsoever, no light at all. I listened for the sound and there was dead silence. With one great rush, I understood the enormity of what I had done. I had been given the greatest of gifts and I had thrown it away. Tears of self-recrimination and self-pity flooded my eyes as I recalled how easy it had been and how thoroughly I had taken for granted that precious gift. I understood very well that now I would have to work hard and struggle in order to regain that which I had lost. That day I wrote a letter to the master. I worked very hard over it, as I was aware that I had not been worthy of what he had given me, and I wanted to impress him. I mailed the letter, and a few days later there was a letter from him in the mailbox. I was amazed. A few days? It took usually a month for letters to get to the master and back. What could this mean? I read the letter, and it was clear that he was not replying to my letter at all. He had written me without my writing him, a very unusual circumstance, and especially unusual, by the way, if you consider that I had been totally off the path, out of contact, not meditating for 2 years. And suddenly, reflecting further, I realized that he must have written the letter about the time I had decided to come back on the path, that his attention had been directed toward me at that time. It was my first awareness of the protection of the master, but by no means the last. And sometime after Eric was born, I received another letter from the master dated October 9th, 1961. This was in the answer to the letter that I had written him. And I'm going to read that letter. It's pretty long, but this is a major document, not only in my life, but I think he covers a lot of ground in this letter. And if you think that he is writing it to somebody, like I said, who had broken many commandments, including some big ones, had been off the path, had not meditated, totally out of it. You know, and you find the patience, the love, the non-rebuking, and the way in which he answered my questions, which I was very concerned about the condition of the world back then, nuclear war seemed very imminent, and it was a very confusing time. Fallout shelters were being built, and I asked him, how could God let such things happen? And Master wrote me, I am glad to find that you have achieved a stable existence in a rural town, small rural town, that is Sanbrinton, and have learnt the trade of a printer to carry on a smooth life. A settled and peaceful life is a helping factor for the spiritual undertakings. My best wishes are with you all. That is, of course, Judith and Miriam and me, and by this time also included Eric, although I hadn't mentioned Eric in my, well, I might have mentioned it in my letter. I am sorry that you had for some long time past neglected your meditations and grown careless in diet and generally lost interest in spiritual things. I'm glad that you are again meditating and have taken a turn for your spiritual side. This will stand in your good stead. You should not take things only from physical angle. While one has to perform physical duties, the duties towards one's own self and God are not less important. Is not body more than raiment, and life more than the meat? What does it profit a man if he gains the possessions of the whole world and loses his own soul? The physical life, together with all its possessions and allurements, is subject to decay and disintegration. The precious moments of earth life spent in the holy meditations are superbly best utilized and are a step in the right direction towards one's eventual return to one's true eternal home. Whether by ups and downs of the world or inner yearnings, one is fortunate to tread on this path of deliverance. You have got the sacred books and at present are reading Nam or Word. What you read in these books is to become a part of your life, and this you will achieve step by step if you are regular and devoted in meditations and develop within from day to day. Man is the noblest of all creation, and the highest ideal in this body is to meet the Lord, and for that purpose he has to know himself first. Self-knowledge precedes God-knowledge. Man has made wonderful progress physically and intellectually, but his spiritual side has been ignored. He is gaining control over the forces of nature in the shape of hydrogen bombs, etc., which are threatening the destruction of all mankind. Had he gained self-knowledge before having this control of forces of nature, these very things would have gone to the service of mankind. These weapons are being used for gaining supremacy over the others. Even the darkest clouds have a silver lining somewhere. To err is human. By suffering, one learns a lesson and tries to avoid sin and looks for virtuous life. This threat of destruction will go a long way to change the trend of humanity for the better, to live and let others live too. Providence has his own miraculous ways for guiding the destiny of child humanity. But the fact remains that a living master is a great blessing, and all those coming under his protective care and guidance will pass off unscathed by following his commandments, namely, love God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy strength, and love thy neighbor as thyself. If we give more value to a thing that is intrinsically do it, the fear of its loss will be considerably out of proportion to the actual facts. You need not worry about anything. Being under the protective care of the great master power, you are really a blessed soul, having always at your disposal the facility of drawing on that great power. The way how to do it is already with you. If you will just walk one step, he will come down a million of steps to pull you, help you, and guide you at every stage. You have simply to tune your receptivity to the fountainhead. The way to do it is to faithfully obey him and devotedly carry on as enjoined. All action has corresponding reaction. An individual action has an individual reaction. Collectively, people are asked to do ethical actions. This brings up good collective reaction. Reverse of it produces collective bad reaction. Nature has its own way of correcting and fulfilling reactions of individual good and bad action. Likewise, collective reactions are to be fulfilled. One may not be able to truly understand the depth of these things, for his perception and understanding is limited to gauge these depths. Internal ascension into higher regions opens our vision to see things clearly. We should therefore strive fully, honestly, faithfully, and diligently to proceed within. Those who are earnest and devoted are crowned with success. Many things become clear, which otherwise, with all the reasoning and intelligence, will be at best hazy and foggy. But to those who are regularly devoted to meditation in the accurate way, their inner development takes them face to face to the radiant form of the Master within, in which God power appears, who talks to them as we talk outside, guides them in all matters. When the time comes for their leaving the physical body, he tells them that they have to go. There's nothing strange in it. It's everyday happening. The spiritual aspirants inculcate a sense of aversion for the sensuous pleasures as they have tasted the elixir of Nam within with the grace of the Master. All beauty and glory lies within. And if you will please be lovingly devoted to your holy meditations in an accurate way, as discussed in a copy of Brief Instructions, which I enclose for your guidance, you will find that you will be benefited immensely with his grace. So please be lovingly devoted with deep faith and sacred earnestness. Master power working overhead will be extending all feasible help, grace, and protection. And the days continued, and so did my struggles with meditation. What had once been ridiculously easy was painfully difficult, and I usually didn't sit for more than a half hour. After a few months, I did begin to hear the sound again, but the light was kept from me until the Master came in person and gave it back to me. Some months later, in the spring of 1962, I learned that there would be a big gathering of disciples from all over the East Coast in Boston on the first weekend in May. I had not seen any brothers and sisters, except for Nina, since I had left the path more than 2 years before. I wanted to go, but I was afraid. I was afraid the others would be more spiritual than me, that they would judge and condemn me both for having left the path and for the circumstances under which I left it, that I would not be at home in such rarefied company, and that I wouldn't like it, and I was afraid of the hazards or uncertainty that precedes anything new or any major departure from the norm. But I also wanted to go, very much. I drove down to Boston on a beautiful Saturday morning, and since the meeting was to be held on Marlborough Street, I parked my old Jeep station wagon in a parking lot near where Marlborough Street runs into the public gardens. Then I walked up the street. As I grew nearer to the building where the meetings were being held, all my fears rose up in one mighty rush, and I began to sweat and tremble. The closer I came, the more certain I was that I couldn't go in. I was noticing the numbers on the doors, and as I drew abreast of the correct house, I made up my mind with absolute conviction. No, I will not go in. I'll call up some of my old friends from the coffee corner and drink beer with them. And I kept on walking. Not more than three steps later, a large, heavy-set, white-haired woman, neatly dressed in black, whom I had never seen before, stood squarely in my way and spoke to me. Hey, do you know which house this Hindu thing is in? I said politely, I believe it's in that one there, pointing. She looked me in the face a moment and then said, come on, let's go in. Grabbed me by the wrist with a vice-like grip and led me into the house, up the stairs, right into the meeting room. Now, this woman was a real person. I later got to know her a little bit, although we never discussed this incident. She was a real person, not an apparition conjured up by the master. But if she had been an apparition, the effect of her appearance on me could not have been greater. This was the second time that the master had deliberately and directly interceded with me to save me from myself. And while it would not be the last time, in some respects it remains in my memory as the most miraculous of all my experiences with him. This incident in bright sunlight on Marlborough Street in Boston, with the master working through the form of an unknown woman, perhaps symbolizes better than any other the basic benevolence of the universe once an individual seeker has committed him or herself to its care. But the fact is that those 2 days of meeting were wonderful. No one judged me. I was treated with great love and respect by everyone. All my fears proved groundless, and I received an enormous lift. Had I not gone in, I doubt that I would have survived. I needed very badly the company of those who were doing the same thing I was. I had gone as far as I could alone, and the master knew it. A few months later, Mr. Khanna, the master's American representative, asked me to hold satsang in San Bernardino. I was reluctant to do so and wrote the master myself to make sure it was really all right with him. He replied that he was glad to learn that I was holding satsang. My reluctance continued, however, and it was not until 6 months later, in January 1963, that we started doing it. In the meantime, in September 1962, we purchased the abandoned farm that later became known as Santpani Ashram. It was never at any time our intention to found an ashram. As I mentioned above, we were looking for an isolated place in the country to live quietly and raise our kids. We had found, as a matter of fact, 3 different places that we were perfectly happy with and had agreed to buy. Each one of them had fallen through at the last minute, and none of them could have functioned as an ashram. But that, of course, was not one of our criteria. In desperation, we had published a classified advertisement in the Laconia Citizen. Wanted, large isolated farmhouse, far from traffic and neighbors. Then Clem Orr, an elderly neighbor and friend who was developing a real estate business, dropped by one day and told us of a place over on the other side of town that might be what we wanted. We went to see it, and it was. Judith fell in love with it immediately. I had my reservations, the main one being that there was going to be an awful lot of work involved. The farm, it had been a dairy farm and apple orchard until a fire in the 1930s destroyed the barn, had been abandoned for many years. Most of the windows were broken. Porcupines had eaten large chunks of the floor, leaving gaping holes. There was no electricity or plumbing of any kind. The only well on the property was dry, and so forth and so on. On our first inspection of the property, I opened the cellar door and started to go down the stairs, but it was pitch dark. I couldn't see a thing, and I decided not to. Later, we went into the cellar from outside by opening the bulkhead door, which let in a lot of light, and we saw that there was no cellar stair. The entire staircase had been eaten by porcupines. That was the first job we worked on, my brother Bruce and I, building that staircase. But it was 2 houses, the large main house, beautifully built, dating from the 1790s, and a smaller, more recent house nearby, and 200 acres for $5,500. And the setting was indeed beautiful. It took us a few days, but we agreed to buy it, and we were very happy. The farm had been owned by Martin Grossman and his wife from New York, but we never met them. They had an agent in San Bernardino, a local farmer, wheeler, dealer named John Hill, whom I had known since high school days. I used to deliver groceries to him. John Hill's family had owned the farm for many years after the fire in the 1930s. and I used to spend summers there, moving out when the snow flies. He ran cattle there still, and when we looked at it, young dairy cattle were grazing within a few feet of the big house. What Martin Grossman sold it for, $5,500, was exactly what he had paid for it when he bought it from John Hill 5 years earlier. And John Hill told me how that purchase had come about. He said that he was in negotiation with a local couple whom I knew well, Richard and Louise Morrison, who wanted very badly to purchase it, and they had agreed on a price and had gone to the bank to see about a mortgage. While they were gone, Mr. Grossman had driven up. The farm was at the end of a dead-end dirt road. Got out of the car, looked around, said to Mr. Hill, "I've been looking for a place like this for many years." Asked him the purchase price, wrote out a check, and gave it to him. When the Morrisons got back, the place had been sold. While this made them very unhappy, they did find a very beautiful farm not far away shortly after. And in the meantime, the Grossmans never visited the place once. Neither did they put it up for sale until we were ready to buy it. It was as though the place was kept in reserve for us. We put some thought into the naming of it. There were two giant maples, both of which have since died, growing near the front door of the big house, and we considered naming it Twin Maple Farm, but we decided we wanted to name it something specifically spiritual. I had an old book which I had bought back around the time of our initiation called Mysticism, The Spiritual Path, Volume 2, by Lake Raj Puri, written in the time of Baba Sawan Singh, Kripal's guru. It was in fact the first book on the path I ever bought, and I liked it very much, not least because of the beautiful picture of Sawan that served as a frontispiece. It was published by the Sant Bani Book Depot, and that name had always resonated with me. I thought it was beautiful. Sant Bani has a variety of meanings on different levels. Can refer to the sound current, to various scriptures or holy books, or to the teachings of the masters. I never was sure exactly which meaning we intended, maybe all of them, but Judith agreed with me that Sant Bani Farm would be a very appropriate name. And so it was called, until Kripal came a year later and renamed it Sant Bani Ashram, which it has been ever since. Years later, during my trip to India in 1969, the following conversation took place between Kripal, Moni Sushil Kumarji, a Jain holy man who worked closely with the Master on the World Fellowship of Religions, and myself. Kripal, he is from America. He has an ashram over there. Moniji, California? Kripal, no, east side, Sant Bani Ashram. Muniji, what does that mean? Kripal, to me, what does Sant Bani Ashram mean? Me, gulp. Well, Sant means the master, Bani means the teachings, and Ashram. At this point, Kripal and Muniji spoke briefly in Hindi, and Kripal said very pointedly to me, Sant Bani Ashram means where the teachings of the masters are put to work. However, thoughts like these were far from our minds in 1962. What was on our minds was the overwhelming realization of how much work there would be in fixing the place up so we could live in it. We started immediately replacing the glass in the windows and redoing the flooring where the porcupines had eaten it. As I said, my brother and I built the cellar staircase first thing. But I was working full-time at the Journal Transcript, and I knew the work was far beyond what I could do on weekends. So Judith and I asked Jim Bax, my old friend and roommate from the coffee corner, if he would like to stay with us for several months and work on the house during the day while I was at work in exchange for room and board, no salary. He was very happy to do that, and he did move in with us. Every day I drove him over to the farm in the morning before I went to work and then picked him up in the late afternoon. Sometimes I would stay and work with him for a while, especially if he was in the middle of something. And on Saturdays, we generally worked together, often with Judith and sometimes with David Wiggins, a young artist whom I had known since he was 5 and I was 13, and who had become the first initiate of Kripal in New Hampshire. He was often away, but when he was home, he helped. He stayed with us through the winter, and a rip-roaring New Hampshire winter it was. And I'm going to skip now a long section. And that May, work on the house at Sanpani Farm had proceeded enough so that we could move in. Very exciting. We had a well drilled and we got water at 74 feet, which was very auspicious as our finances were very limited at this point. Electricity had been put in, but we didn't have a telephone for 4 years and plumbing came slowly. We didn't have a flush toilet for several months after we moved in. But at this point, news of the master's forthcoming visit reached us, and motivated by God knows what, we wrote to Mr. Khanna and invited the master to Sanpani Farm. Not long after, we were pleased to get a schedule of the tour in the mail, and we saw that the master was due at Sanpani Farm on October 11th, 1963. It was now May or early June, I don't remember exactly which, and the house was still in terrible shape. Between then and October lay an incredible amount of work. Now, why we invited the master to come to our house is, you know, I cannot remember what on earth was going on in our mind. Why should we have this farmhouse in terrible shape? We knew it was 6 months before he was coming, the tour was starting. And why on earth we thought he would want to come? The whole thing is totally incomprehensible. All of this stuff, you know, is totally incomprehensible to me. Why did John Hill sell the place to Martin Grossman when he had, you know, a couple going to the bank to get financing that he had agreed to? I mean, the short answer is that that's the way John Hill was. He always was more interested in the cash right in hand than what might come in the future, I guess. But that's the way the master works, you know. He works through us, through what we are. And somehow or other, he worked through Judith and me to get him there. Although I don't know what, I have no idea what was on our minds, what we thought. I just don't know. Anyway, July 1st was Judith's birthday, and to celebrate, we took an unplanned trip to Boston. We stopped in to see our old friend and mentor, Seymour Swetsoff, at his frame shop on Beacon Hill, and invited him to come see our place. He knew that the master had agreed to go there, and he was curious, so he did indeed come up and visit us the next day. He took one look at the inside of the house and blanched. "My God, you expect the master to come to this place? You must be out of your minds." It was a real wake-up call. From then on, we devoted our every waking minute to preparing for the master's coming. Very shortly after that, as I explain in detail, I lost my job at the Transcript, which is a very good thing because otherwise it wouldn't have been ready. And there was, let me jump ahead here. There was, we worked day and night. Judith and I did nothing but work on the house 12 or 14 hours a day. My meditations, which were no good anyway, were forgotten about. Judith kept hers up by getting by with 2 hours sleep a night, literally. All sense of a future was lost. As far as we were concerned, the world ended on October 11th, the day Master was coming. Those were difficult days in many ways, but I think they were the happiest days of my life up to that point, despite the fact that the repairs on the house involved our going into debt with absolutely no assurance of being able to pay it back. But we could see only one thing. The master was coming. And I explain how master gave me back the light. On Thursday, October 10th, his last day in Boston and the day before he came to Sanpani, he gave initiation. Something very strong told me to attend that initiation, and I did. I got up early on a frosty morning and drove down to Boston, my heart singing. Master had given me peace, though I could see no reason for it. At the initiation, the first ever that I had attended with Master personally conducting, he gave me back everything I had lost and more besides. Never in my life had I swum in the ocean of light as I did that blessed golden morning in Boston. Oh, God, thank you. Oh, God, thank you. I kept saying over and over, tears in my eyes. After the sitting, the master came around asking the new initiates what they had seen. He came to the back where we older ones were sitting and said, asked cheerfully, everything all right here? I could say nothing. I looked at him and caught his eye and he twinkled. Oh, thank God, thank God. And it was all him. He knew all about everything and always had. The following day, he came to St. Bonnie Farm and our new life in him began. Later, it seemed that the great gulf fixed between the old and the new opened on this day. One 24-hour period and what changes it wrought. All of the hard work and the nightmare anxiety of the previous 5 weeks faded away in the unearthly joy those 24 hours brought. After it was over, I reflected that it was the one event in my life that had not only been as good as I could have imagined, but infinitely better. I understood for the first time what it is like to be loved, really loved, by someone who knew what I really was. I had a taste, that is, of the love of God. I had gone with our 3.5-year-old daughter, Miriam, to the nearest exit off Interstate 93 to meet him in the caravan, 5 or 6 cars that were accompanying him. When we arrived at St. Bonnie, I jumped out of my car and rushed over to his. Judith, with our 2-year-old son, Eric, in her arms, was already greeting him. He spoke to us very kindly and slowly climbed the little hill on which the house stood. When he reached the front door, he turned and looked slowly and thoughtfully over the beautiful New Hampshire landscape spread out before him. He laughed and said very quietly, almost under his breath, "Nature is always beautiful, except when tormented by man." Then he went in the house. A little later, Judith and I were looking out the back window when we saw him walking up the little hill behind the house to a large and prominent rock under a cherry tree. This, of course, now in the things we saw in the movie. He was accompanied only by Bibi Hardevi, called Taiji, his housekeeper, who looked after his needs. When he reached the rock, he took off his turban and lay down on the grass, Taiji squatting nearby. Judith and I watched wide-eyed. We nudged each other in suppressed excitement. What happened then was surely the most lighthearted satsang ever. As the disciples discovered where he was, they gathered around him. There were about 15 or 20 people. While he sat on the rock, put them in meditation, tossed them prasad apples, joked and teased with them, took pictures of them because they had been taking pictures of him, and in general made them very happy. But not me. I and 3 others were at the Unitarian Church in nearby Franklin, where the master was scheduled to speak that night, getting the auditorium ready for his talk. We missed the whole thing. That night the master gave his talk, and I'm going to read a little bit of it, not a whole lot. I read the final 3 paragraphs. So I am here not to advocate any new religion to you. Remain where you are, but be true Christians. What did Christ say? Open the inner eye to see the light of God within you. He who sees the light of God is a true Christian. And if you have not seen the light of God, then we've joined that school, of course, but we have not become true Christians. Similarly, a Sikh is one who sees the light of God. Remain in the outer forms. That's the first step. To belong, to believe in some religion is a blessing, but you must rise above. If we did not live in any religion, there would be corruption, or we would have to invent new religions. Why don't you stay in the religions which have stood the test of time? If there is any corruption, you see, just leave it aside and follow the true teachings which the masters gave from time to time. So as I told you, I have not come to advocate new religions. Remain where you are. This is the truth that has been given by all masters. Just try to meet somebody who knows the way. We want a teacher in any line, you see. Whatever subject you have to take, naturally sit at his feet. He is your true friend, your true brother. He is competent to give you some experience. And all credit goes to him. No son of man can do it, but the God in him, which is manifest, he is competent to raise you up and give you an experience of his own self, you see. With these few words, I'm glad I've been here at Sant Bani Ashram for a day. They wanted me to speak something, what little I know. To the best I can, I have given you a digest of the same in a few words. These words are for your calm consideration. If you've got true hunger, thirst for God, it is God above who has to make the arrangements. He will bring you in contact somewhere where you can be put on the way. So whenever masters come, they see people from the level of the human body or from the level of the embodied soul, not from the level of the outer badges of different religions that we are carrying. That is why his first work is to collect all children of God together, not to blend their religions into one, to let them simply remain where they are, but to rise above body consciousness to come to the truth, you see. And he has the competency to raise you up and give you the experience within to start with. So thank you for your patient hearing. And then he took questions and answers. He took questions and gave answers. And I'll read a few of them. Did the master say that one day we would reach perfection? And the master said, yes, there is hope in a human body, you see. I would say we have got the birthright to be perfect, to know God. Christ said, be ye perfect as your Father is in heaven. If there were no hope, I don't think that he would give him that statement. We are spirit in man, and spirit is perfect. We are simply environed by mind and matter and other things. When we shake off, we are perfect, you see. And human body is the only time, the golden opportunity, which we have got to go back home. Question, do you declare that when we drop this body that we take on another one? And Master said, there is life after death, that's definite, that's sure. I have come from India. I am no more in India, but here in America. There is a transfer from the physical to the astral. I told you from the beginning that macrocosm is in the microcosm of the human body. God has given us bodies to work through the three planes. In the physical plane, we have the physical body. When we shake it off at the time of death, or even if now we are able to shake it off, of course, with the guidance of somebody you know who can take us into the beyond, if we shake off all these three bodies, we see we are souls. God is within us and we are in God. And obviously the questioner was asking about reincarnation, and Master's answer does not really relate to that, as you could see. So she said, do I understand you that after death there'll be a rebirth on earth again? And Master said, well, you see, my point is some masters have referred to it and some have not. Question, reincarnation? Master, I tell you, some masters have referred to it, reincarnation, and others have not referred to it. The same question was asked of me when I went to Pakistan. Muslims generally don't believe in reincarnation. These people came up to me, so many, and said, well, do you believe in reincarnation? I told them the very same words that I have now told you, that some have referred to reincarnation and others have not. Then I told them, before I reply to you further, I would like to ask one question from you. I have come to Pakistan. I am abiding by all the laws of this country. I am living very lovingly with all. Everybody lives lovingly with me. With all that, you have got prison houses, a police department, and records. I say there is no police or imprisonment for me. So the masters who have not referred to it say, become true Christians. When you live by God, you see, you love God the most. Where is reincarnation for you? That's only for those who are attached to the world, you see? That's why some masters have not referred to it. So I think that the human body is the highest in all creation. We have got the golden opportunity, and we can live if we can find God within this human body. Where's the question of returning? And the questioner, understandably, said, I still don't know if I understand you right or not. You do believe in reincarnation? And Master said, past masters have left their proofs for that, you see. Direct proofs, paper proofs, and even incidents they remember from their past births, and that has been checked too. But not for the souls who have attained God, you see. And if you read the questions and answers carefully, you will note that Master is not at all clear about whether he teaches reincarnation or not, much to the frustration of one lady who kept trying to get a straight answer. Of course, he did teach it, but there is a story behind the obfuscation. Among the attendees was a man named Gerald Boyce. He was a native of Franklin and worked at the G.W. Griffin Company hacksaw factory most of his adult life as a troubleshooter. He had spent time with the great teacher Krishnamurti in Ojai, California. Had been a vegetarian since the age of 25, when a farmer's wife he was working for had asked him to kill a chicken, and he found he couldn't do it. Had grown his hair and beard long at a time when no one, and I mean no one, did such a thing, and had two things in his mind about Kripal by way of tests. Did he wear leather? Did he teach reincarnation? He had studied the occult scripture Oaspe for many years. And while that book advocates vegetarianism, it denies reincarnation. And to him, wearing leather was not consistent with vegetarianism. When the master came in the hall that night, he was in his stocking feet. He had left his leather shoes outside. This was not at all his usual practice, and I noticed it at the time. Then, of course, Gerald heard the talk and loved it. As he told me later, I saw it had an inner logic to it. When the questions about reincarnation came up, what he got from it was that the master didn't teach it. By the time he found out the truth of it, he didn't care anymore. He was totally convinced of Kripal's greatness and was initiated a year later. And of course, the noteworthiest thing of all, the master's reference to Sant Pani Ashram. Prior to this, our farm had never been referred to that way. After this, it was never referred to any other way. Judith had ridden to the church that night in the car with the master. On the way in, he said to her, "Your husband missed everything this afternoon." She explained that I was preparing the hall for the talk that night, and he nodded. The following morning, the master held a group meditation at our now ashram. It was the first time I had meditated since the master had given me back the light 2 days before. This time the light was even more intense and more bright, and through it I caught glimpses of much more. When the master came to me afterward, I told him what I had seen, and he twinkled. Later I went up to him and said, "I just want to thank you for that beautiful meditation this morning. I know I couldn't have done it by myself." He looked at me and said matter-of-factly, "Well, you missed all the fun yesterday," and smiled into my eyes. Before the meditation started, I noticed that Gerald Boyce, of course I didn't know his name then, had just walked in. The master saw him and said to me, "Now it's time to start. People are arriving." I later found out that Gerald had walked the entire distance from Tilton, where he was living, to the ashram in Sanbrinton, by way of Franklin, where he had hoped to find a cab, but the cab company wasn't open yet, a distance of some 15 miles. When he arrived, it was time to start. Later that same morning, the master was standing behind the big house alone, and I went up to him. Last night, I heard you refer to this place as an ashram. Judith and I have talked it over, and we agreed that we would like to give it to you. He said with great emphasis, "You keep custody. Maintain it according to my teachings, that's all." We all left around noontime after an orgy of picture-taking for Kripal Ashram in Vermont, managed by Nina Jitana. On the way out, an incident occurred which none of us, except the master, were remotely aware of at the time. Yet it is an excellent example of how the master works. We think we understand what he is doing. We include him in our mental catalog of categories we are familiar with. Yet the truth is, we see only the barest sliver of what he is and what his activities include. The following is an article written by Charlene Girouard much later and published in the August 1993 issue of Saint Bonnie magazine. The year was 1963, the month October. I was 12 years old, living with my family in Massachusetts. My oldest sister was going to a Catholic boarding school in Hudson, New Hampshire, about an hour's drive from Franklin. One Sunday, our whole family drove over to visit her. After leaving the rest of the family at the boarding school, my dad decided to go for a drive in the country, so I went along with him. Dad loved to ride up and down the winding dirt roads, which were quite common in that part of the country, to see what was at the end. On this particular day, we had gone some distance down a steep dirt driveway. We had gone some distance down a road when my father slowed to a stop to let four or five cars coming down a steep dirt driveway drive past us. While we watched, a man in the back seat of the first car leaned forward with his hands folded and bowed slightly to my father, while staring at him quite penetratingly and very seriously. He had a white beard and a white turban and deep-set eyes. I was in the back seat and had seen him, but he had not looked at me. I zoomed over to the other side of the car, and with my face pressed against the glass window, just hoped for some reason, I didn't understand why, with all my heart, that this man would look at me too. Just when it seemed the moment had been lost, he leaned forward and with folded hands looked at me. Very sadly, I thought, in my 12-year-old mind, why is he so sad? But then I felt a sense of relief. He had looked at me. Somehow this was very important. Well, Dad and I decided to go up this driveway and investigate. A turban and a white beard in New Hampshire. At the top was a wood frame house. A sign read Saint Bonnie Farm. Being Catholic and my father being French, I thought maybe it was a farm for men studying to be priests and dedicated to the Catholic Saint Boniface in French. My father shrugged his shoulders and we drove back to the boarding school, picked up the rest of the family and drove home. Over the years, I forgot about the incident, although the picture of that man with the long white beard always intrigued me. I left home at an early age, but returned home for visits periodically over the course of the years. Meanwhile, my parents had relocated to Eastern Canada. A few years before my dad passed away in 1986, he started mentioning this incident to me from time to time, but with some embarrassment. He was a strict Catholic. Around this time, he would occasionally complain to me of a ringing in his right ear. Since I had taken some nursing training and he was a dentist, we would try to figure out the cause. I don't know if he mentioned it to the other members of the family. Sometimes we would just be sitting together eating, and this ringing would start in his ear. He found it quite annoying. A few months before my father passed away, which was quite suddenly at home of a heart attack, we were sitting at the table and he asked me bashfully if I remembered that strange man in the white beard, referring to that fateful encounter in 1963. He told me that he was having dreams about him that seemed so real. We both wondered who he had been. As he was telling me about the dreams, I could tell he was disturbed, but somehow happy about them. Well, we just looked at each other and wondered what it was all about. After my father died, I dreamt about him 3 or 4 different times. In the last dream, he told me he was doing great and that he was on his way to New Jerusalem. It was a phrase he had never used while alive, and I was not familiar with it until a couple of months before my initiation in 1989, when I found reference to it in Sant Kripal's book, Nam. In December 1988, 2 years after my father died, I was sleeping and was awakened by a touch on my forehead. This happened a couple more times and led to a number of inner experiences, but they were without figure or form. Meanwhile, a satsangi was working where I was employed, and I felt quite drawn to her as she seemed to evoke that same warm, loving quality that was akin to my nighttime experiences. Well, one thing led to another. She lent me a book on Sant Nat. I asked her for another. I bought 2 more of my own. First, I was not at all interested in Santji. By then, I had remembered vividly the incident with Master Kripal in 1963 and recognized his face from the pictures in the Sant Nat books I was reading. I realized that my father was safe. He was with Kripal. As I sat reading these books and looking at the pictures of Santji, I was drawn to those eyes. Although if anyone had told me even a few months earlier that I was going to have a master, I would have laughed. But Santji had his way and has his ways. I fell in love with him. A few trips to the ashram in Surrey, British Columbia, a few satsangs, a few weeks of his eyes, and I wanted initiation, which came that summer. Now, I'm almost done, but I would like to just comment on how all this comes together. You know, Santji used to say that we think, I am going to satsang, I want to get initiation, I plan to do this, I plan to do that. But that's, you know, that's just illusion. That in reality, the master does everything. And I would point out that both my personal life and experience and in the events surrounding the establishment of the ashram, that everything was a gift. You know, the master gave us, I couldn't meditate worth a darn. And master gave me, you know, he gave me back the inner light. Judith and I didn't, we had no intention of having an ashram. That thought had never occurred to us once until master said those words in the church that night. When he said, Sant Bani Ashram, we both of us knew, we didn't even have to speak to each other. We both of us knew that was what was going to happen. And yet, you know, we did not do a good job, by and large, running the ashram. It was not because we were good at it that we were chosen for that. It was because we needed it. This is a point I've often made in the past. It regards all sevadars, actually. But in this case, it was particularly obvious. We made every mistake in the book, and we resented half the time what was required. It was worked against all our private interests. And yet the ashram flourished, you know, and it grew, and many people came during the late 60s. We did the Sangha here was still small in the late 60s, but that changed after my trip to India in 69. But before that, the Sangha was small, but people came to the ashram from all over and spent a lot of time here. And some people just stayed on and on and on. And people got initiated. And, you know, it's like there's somebody, Bill Myers, who many of you know, used to come up. He was living with Mr. Conrad at the time. He used to come up and visit. And he said to us one time, you know, I like coming here because this is where the action is. That was the way it seemed to people. And then, of course, later on, after my trip to India, the Sangha grew exponentially in just a very short time. Went from 25 people in the fall of 69 to 75 by the spring of 1970. And it kept on growing. And that's when we had to build the satsang hall. But none of that was the doing of any individual, you know. Nothing that Judith and I did was particularly helpful as far as you know, the work of the ashram. We did our best, God knows. Well, most of the time we did our best. I can't say we did our best all the time. But there it is. Anyway, Master gave that to us. He had his reasons. He worked it so that the ashram would come into our hands just at the time when he was coming. I mean, he worked everything. You know, how did he? He wrote me a letter and brought me back to the path in one afternoon when I had been absolutely convinced that I was totally off it. He came in the person of an old woman in Boston and had me drag me into that building when I had absolutely decided not to go in. All of this, you know, and when he gave me back the inner light, I understood very clearly, nobody earns meditation. Sometimes the masters speak that way, and there's a sense in which it is true. But the real meaning of it is that the master gives us whatever we get inside, you know, and he may give it or he may not give it. And I learned, you know, for 2 years, he didn't give it. And then he did. And wow, you know, I mean, he can do anything. And he knows everything. And all I can say is I am extremely grateful and very much in awe of the fact that the Master intervened in my life and the lives of those whom I love. And made our lives worth something, you know. The one good thing, as Larry Robison said, and I quoted the other day, and as is often told in the story of the moneylender and the master, the one good thing that I have done was to come in contact with a genuine master. And that made all the difference. And that's the truth of it, you know. And it's all a gift from him. None of it is from us. It's all from him. And I thank God for that, because what comes from us usually ruins us. All right. I'm finally done. Been long-winded. But I thank you, as Master used to say, I thank you for your patient hearing. God bless us all.
Thank you, Russell. Thank you so much. And let us now continue in meditation or continue on ourselves in the sweet remembrance of God. May God bless us all.